The Gopher Legislative Advisory Board was created by Executive Order 2020-06. That order is publicly available on the governor's website. Today's meeting is an official meeting of the board, is open to the public, and will be run in a manner compliant with RSA 91-A. We have someone on the phone taking minutes, which will be posted to the Gopher webpage. Today's meeting is also being recorded, as we've already said. Should you be a speaking participant and not wish to be recorded, you may disconnect now. My name is Jerry Little. I am Director of the Governor's Office for Emergency Relief and Recovery, and I will facilitate today's meeting. Because the board is meeting by phone, under RSA 91A, there are a few logistics that we need to do first. Each of us now must state our names, where we are located, and who is in the room with us. So we'll do this by roll call. I am Jerry Little, Director of the Gopher, in the Gopher offices at One Eagle Square in Concord. In the room with me, Kate Spiner, Rhonda Hensley, Joe Dorian, President Donna Susi, are you with us?
Yes, I am. This is Donna Susi. I am at my home in Manchester, and I am alone.
Speaker Steve Shurtleff. Speaker Shurtleff. Leader Chuck Morse.
This is Chuck Morse. I'm in my office in Atkinson, and I am alone.
Leader Dick Hinch.
This is Dick Hinch. I am on the line. I'm in my office in Merrimack, and I am alone.
Thank you, sir. Chairman Lou D'Alessandro.
This is Lou D'Alessandro. I'm in my kitchen, and I am alone.
Chairwoman Mary Jane Wallner.
This is Mary Jane Wallner. I'm in my home in Concord, New Hampshire, and I am alone.
Senator John Reagan.
John Reagan. I'm in my home office alone.
Representative Aaron Hennessy.
Aaron Hennessy. I'm in my home in Littleton with my two minor children.
Thank you, Representative. I'll try Speaker Steve Shurtleff again.
Aaron, I'm at my cabin up in Bethlehem.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you.
As we move through our agenda today, each board member and anyone else speaking is asked to identify themselves before speaking. Should you choose to take votes today, they must be done by a roll call following the process we just used. Finally, before we begin today's presentations, please remember to hit the numbers 5-star on your keypad if you would like to ask a question. Also, presenters on the line with us today are asked to hit 5-star when their turn comes up, as that allows us to unmute your line. Are there any questions before we begin today's scheduled presentations? Hearing none, we will move right into our presentations for today. Our schedule
Jerry,
today, Senator D'Alessandro, yes?
Yeah, before we start the presentation, could I ask just a couple of things of you?
Yes, sir.
Two points. Since the Treasury has released guidelines relative to the eligible uses of the CRF, could we find out or someone provide us a written legal opinion on the allowable uses of the $1.25 billion in CARES funds?
The document
should also on the state's ability to consider funding to municipalities and what restrictions, if any, would be placed on those funds by the federal government. And secondly, would it be advisable to say that based on the fact that they're talking in Washington about revisions of the guidelines, would we ask that half of the study be reserved until the end of the month if indeed different guidelines or an update on the guidelines are going to be issued?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's it. Thank you very much. Those two points.
Yep, I can give you a couple answers now. Obviously, we were not expecting to get the guidance until probably sometime today, and we were anticipating that, like other forms of guidance, that it would be several hundred pages long and require a lot of interpretation or studying at least to understand how we can use the funds. We received the guidance Wednesday evening. I distributed it to everyone on this committee very quickly that evening. I'm sure you've noticed that it is 3.5 scant pages of guidance, which isn't much guidance at all, which leaves us with a lot of interpretation and analysis to do, and hopes that you are correct that there will be revisions of the guidance coming forward in the future. The initial interpretation that I have been told of by legal staff at the governor's office is that these funds may not be used to replace revenue lost due to weak tax collection at municipalities and counties. The funds are to be used specifically for expenses that are documented and attributable to response to the coronavirus. And the apparent ruling is that that does not mean that we can use, it means we cannot use the money to offset weak revenue income from at municipalities and counties. So does that address your, oh, and you asked if we could have a written legal opinion. We do have staff downstairs who are working on an analysis, but given the how scant the guidance is, any analysis that we do for you is not going to cover, I'm afraid, probably a lot of the scenarios that you are curious about, because they're simply not addressed in the guidance. But we will get, as a matter of fact, planning on having a presentation for you on the guidance on our agenda for Monday. So when we gather again next week on Monday, one of the items on our agenda will be analysis of the guidance. We will do our best to put something in writing to you beforehand. Does that answer your question, Senator D'Alessandro?
Thank you very much.
Senator Morse, do you have a question?
No, I just wanted to put some clarity to, we actually are trying to set up two meetings next week. I spoke with Donna Lee Lozo that maybe we can join in on their meeting at sometime in the afternoon on Tuesday to follow up with more questions. So I think Monday and Tuesday will be presentations as to what we could spend money on. And I know the requests are coming pretty quick that we need to start spending. So I think we're going to have to get all our answers in Monday and Tuesday. So.
We understand the question. I'm not sure we're going to be able to answer everything, because we would have to be able to anticipate and analyze every potential request. And I'd be afraid that if we put something down in writing for you on Monday and Tuesday and said these are the only things that we could fund, we would preclude ideas that people might bring forward. The bottom line and most simple answer, as I understand it, is we may not replace lost revenues. We can help people with expenses that are directly attributable to COVID-19.
Yeah, Jerry, I think the way this is going to work is if someone comes up with a proposal to fund $1 million to something, we're going to have to legally run each and every idea. I think Monday and Tuesday will give us a general sense. And many of us have been on conference calls looking for clarity already. So I think the process publicly with this committee will be Monday and Tuesday. Let's leave it at that. I think there'll be a lot more questions that people will be working on over the weekend. So.
I agree. Thank you. Any further questions before we start on the agenda? Hearing none, I guess I will ask if I'm sorry, was that a question? From 1 to 1:30, I'm seeing that we have Kathleen Reardon from the New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits on, and that from 1:30 to 2 o'clock, Dick Ober from the Charitable Foundation will be on, and I think there's been some level of coordination between the two of you. Kathleen, are you speaking first in this block of time?
I'm going to introduce myself, and then we're sharing the hour of time, Commissioner Little, based on your recommendation that we coordinate. And I would love to just introduce myself and then introduce Dick, and then I'll start.
Great. Thank you very much. Go right ahead.
Okay. So good afternoon. Thank you, Commissioner Little, and all of you for focusing this day's presentations on the New Hampshire nonprofit sector. My name is Kathleen Reardon. I am the CEO of the New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits, which is dedicated to strengthening and giving voice to New Hampshire's nonprofits. We are proud to have more than 700 members, but we serve the entire nonprofit sector. As I mentioned, Dick Ober is here with me, and he's going to say a few words before I go into my presentation.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
My name is Dick Ober. I'm the president of the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation. I'm at home in Dublin today. I would like to add to Kathleen's thanks for this opportunity to speak and for everything that you all are doing to help the state at this time. Hundreds of nonprofit organizations are on the front lines of this crisis, providing for the public good. They're treating the sick and the elderly, feeding kids whose parents have lost jobs, caring for kids whose parents are still working. They're sheltering the homeless, treating the disabled, counseling people with addiction and mental health. And they're also collaborating very closely, as always, with business and local government and school districts. I'm going to avoid naming specific organizations today, other than the two who are going to say a few words along with us. But you all, as state leaders and local leaders, you know these groups because they're in your communities. We have three goals today. The first is to present an overview of the nonprofit sector. We want to also show the staggering impact of COVID-19 on the ability of nonprofits to serve the public and share some initial thoughts on how the coronavirus relief fund could be used to mitigate those impacts. Thank you again, and I'll turn it back to Kathleen.
So I'd like to start out talking a little bit about the nonprofit sector in New Hampshire to provide a base of understanding for who these organizations are. I had I sent in advance a copy of the center's latest report about nonprofit organizations. For those who are listening on the phone and would like to access that data, it is available on our website at nhnonprofits.org/2019. As Dick has stated, nonprofits really do provide critical services that promote the well-being of our citizens and our communities. They are diverse in their mission focus, but united in their focus on the common good in New Hampshire. Most of all, I want to point out that nonprofits are employers. Prior to this outbreak, there were 83,000 employees that were employed by the nonprofit in the workforce. That's 15% of our state's workforce. They are an important part of our economy, estimating receiving $11 billion in revenues each year. As you'll note, the subsectors, those that are listed on our report, of nonprofits, 32% are in human services, 18% in education. And I would note that education is a very inclusive category, not just private education, but organizations that provide educational services include libraries and organizations like the center or others, preschool, early education. 12% are in the arts and culture area, 7% health, 7% environment. And you can see the breakdown further, but those are the highest percentage by the number of organizations in the sector in New Hampshire. Those are based in New Hampshire and providing services in New Hampshire. One of the things that I think is really helpful for people to understand is that there is no one business model for nonprofits. Nonprofits rely upon a mix of revenues, including government contracts, earned income from programs, philanthropic support, investment, and other income. Almost all of these revenue streams have been impacted by the coronavirus. Some examples of how you can think about these diverse business models, different organizations have a different mix. There are some examples that you can look at on the fourth page of the report. For example, organizations that focus on education, child care, community-based health care programs are highly reliant on program revenue, but of course oftentimes still do need and rely on grants and philanthropy as well. Theaters and museums may also fit into that category. Many organizations in New Hampshire, almost all organizations in New Hampshire rely on some level of philanthropy, but some are more reliant. You think about some of the organizations like homeless shelters and hunger organizations whose clients really cannot pay for their services. So, again, it's helpful to understand that there is a diversity of business models. As we go into what the impacts are, that's a great basis for understanding. I want to go into now a little bit about what we're hearing from nonprofits and seeing happening in our community. Since the pandemic hit, the center has done a couple of pulse surveys. The first one took place was out the week of March 16th, which you may recall was the first week after Governor Sununu declared a state of emergency. And we found even that early on, virtually all respondents had major disruptions to their organizations and working quickly to adapt their services to meet critical needs in our communities while keeping their constituents, staff, and volunteers safe. 85% had already experienced financial hardships. 89% had canceled programs or events, which are significant revenue streams. Again, many of these programs are both mission impact, helping their clients, as well as a way that they support their business. Some noted that fundraising events that they canceled typically bring in more than 25% of their annual revenue. We did another survey more recently. It just was out last week, and some of the preliminary responses at the early part of this week, we wanted to focus a little bit more on the economic impacts and how nonprofits are faring and what demands this crisis is creating. 38% of all respondents have experienced an increase in demand for services at a time when their revenues are really struggling. But for organizations in the human service sector, 45% are experiencing an increased demand, which is not surprising. A couple of examples. I would note, you know, a Family Resource Center noted that they've had a huge increase in the number of families who are requiring more intensive family support. That support used to involve weekly or biweekly visits with the family in their home. It now involves FaceTime chats, phone calls, texting, sometimes several calls each day, many times over an hour each call. They're making these calls to help their families get what they need, find sources for groceries, formula, diapers, as well as support in their role as parents. While this increase in demand is being seen, 92% of nonprofits responding to this Pulse survey have experienced a loss in revenue. When you consider the revenue as a percentage of their budget, the average losses represent 34% of their total budget. Again, we've seen program revenue decrease as well as contributed revenue in particular. Many organizations have also incurred significant unanticipated expenses. They've had to do things like purchase PPEs, additional cleaning efforts, overtime pay, increases in pay to retain essential workers. Many of them instituted that before the state provided those much welcome and appreciated stipends for those workers that are on the front line. An example is from a congregate care facility for youth, a very small one. They noted that although their funding from the state has increased, their cost for payroll has close to doubled. And the needs of their youth are even more intense because they're managing their mental health, lack of visits with family, and also trying to provide treatment in the midst of a crisis. As all of these things are taking place, nonprofits have responded accordingly. 61% have suspended some operations as required to support social distancing, but at the same time, 44% have increased some operations. In many cases, organizations have done both. For example, organizations like WISE and Boys and Girls Club have closed their facilities but are now increasing services such as drive-through food programs, online wellness programs, and virtual check-ins for seniors. Museums and environmental educational organizations that are closed are now providing virtual programs that support our schools in their shift to online learning. And we have seen layoffs in the sector, but much less than in some other industries. It's a little bit mixed depending on the subsector. 45% of the respondents in the survey have instituted layoffs, but if you look at that within the organizations that are in the arts sector, 71% have instituted layoffs. Many of us can't lay people off. We are experiencing increased needs, and we're responding to that as well. I will also note that many nonprofits were very hopeful to get access to forgivable loans through the PPP program. But that program, as we've all heard, has been a little bit uneven across the landscape of both small businesses and nonprofits. In some cases, nonprofits were at a disadvantage because they didn't have an existing relationship with a bank. We found that 47% applied and were approved, while 20% applied but were waiting for decisions and still haven't heard. Many small organizations commented that they did not think that they were eligible or that funds were depleted before they were able to apply. Throughout this crisis, we've seen nonprofits step up to meet the needs of the communities. They're quickly adapting and will continue to do so as we move our state towards the recovery. They are doing all they can to sustain their operations through this crisis, but they need support. Thank you for now more than ever. It will really take all efforts of all three sectors working together to enjoy our communities. I'd like to just ask Dick if he had a couple other words now.
Yeah, thank you, Kathleen. Just a couple of additional examples of what we're hearing at the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation. In a usual year, we fund about 1,800 unique nonprofit organizations and make something in the range of 4,000 or 5,000 grants. On the first three weeks since the outbreak began and the emergency orders were announced, we've seen a 50% increase in grant applications at our foundation, and we've been able to create a 100% increase in the grants we've made over this same period last year. We are receiving, as Kathleen is, multiple calls every day. Demand is up, revenue is down. There's a fundamental paradox, as you all know, with nonprofits. When your quote-unquote business is up, when more and more clients need you, your revenues almost by definition are down, because you're in a down economy. So unlike a private business where more customers, more clients mean more revenue, ironically, more clients, more customers probably mean less revenue for the vast majority of nonprofits. We'd like now actually to hear from two nonprofit directors. First up, and I'll introduce them both now, and they can follow one another. First up is Martha Stone from Crossroads House in Portsmouth, and she'll be followed by Nikki Clark from the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord.
Great. Thank you, Dick. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today. I'm Martha Stone. I'm the executive director of Crossroads House, which is an emergency shelter provider located in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. We serve a large population area that includes all of eastern Rockingham County, all of Stratford County, and even a couple of main communities across the border. We are providing emergency shelter for men, women, and families with children. And our services are comprehensive in that in addition to shelter, we provide meals, case management, supportive services, and collaborate with many other partners in our sector to deliver the supportive services that our residents need. At the time of the outbreak, we were already operating over our typical capacity, which would be about 96 beds. Today, we're providing services for 115 people, and that includes 27 children. When the pandemic hit, the most immediate concerns and impacts for us included the following. As an essential service, we could not close, despite the fact that we lost some staff who were unable to continue to come to work, and only a few of our staff members could work remotely from home just because of the nature of the work that we do. We serve a very vulnerable population from a health perspective. Statistics have shown that people who are experiencing homelessness often have compromised medical conditions, which was certainly a concern given the current crisis. We needed to very quickly identify a place that could serve as an isolation and or quarantine site to avoid a potential mass outbreak should we have someone test positive, given that our shelter is very much a congregate setting. So if any of you have never seen what it looks like here, we have large dorm rooms with many bunk beds that are spaced only 2 to 3 feet apart. So the ability to comply with CDC recommendations was nearly impossible. We worked as quickly as possible to adapt and modify nearly every operating procedure in our shelter to try to come as close as possible in compliance with the CDC recommendations. Part of that included implementing a decompression plan to reduce the numbers of people actually staying in the shelter by moving out to a local motel those who were either the most medically vulnerable or those who were still working in the community, and because coming and going and returning to the shelter every night was an additional exposure. We also created an entirely new meal service plan, and as of Monday, we'll be implementing, working with state officials to conduct testing on-site, similar to what you've seen in regards to nursing homes that have had mobile testing sites. We have concern that studies are showing that many people are testing positive but are asymptomatic. And despite the fact that we've implemented a pretty robust screening tool, if you're asymptomatic, that's not going to help us. We had to get creative to adapt and achieve everything I just listed above. And we have multiple public-private partnerships that helped us accomplish where we are today. We have a local hotel, the AC Hotel in Portsmouth, that's cooking lunch and dinner for us. The Stonewall Kitchen Cafe is making breakfast. And the Port in Portsmouth is a local lodging partner that is helping us with reduced rates to accommodate those who we decided to move out of the shelter and into motel rooms. All of these arrangements were actually secured in conjunction with working with our city officials that included our city manager, our health inspector, and the local fire chief. In addition, we also have been working with the Bureau of Housing Supports and state officials at the EOC. So like many nonprofits, we absolutely do not operate in a silo. We are leaning on our partner agencies to learn from them and also sharing what we have learned. and working with the public-private partnerships as well has really been beneficial for us. We continue to work hard to keep our residents and staff safe. That's really been our priority. And, of course, we need to remain open and operational. It would be pretty catastrophic if we had to close, and those thoughts did cross our mind when this started, because where would we house 115 people if all of a sudden I didn't have enough staff or we had a crisis that required us to close? So we've worked really hard to make sure that we can continue to deliver our services, and we're open 24/7, 365. So in the short term, we are focused on identifying funding sources to support our work. Our budget is just under $2 million a year, and each year we have to raise $1.1 million of that, so just over half, comes from private donations. We had to cancel our one largest fundraiser, our only fundraiser, that had been budgeted to produce $400,000 in annual revenue, and right in line with the statistics that Kathleen shared with you, that represents about a third of our annual operating budget. So that was a tremendous loss of revenue for us. And we, too, have increased costs. We've got the hotel, motel rooms that we're paying for. That's a $12,000 a week bill. We have hazard pay and overtime expenses and many other smaller charges related to, you know, extra sanitation and all the steps that we've taken in our shelter. In the long term, we're focused on the fact that because we rely so heavily on private philanthropy and donations, 75% of our entire budget every year has been coming from donations. So in a down economy, our concern is whether donors will have those resources to continue to support us in our needs. The second thing that is of most concern is that we could experience a surge in demand for shelter once the moratorium on evictions is lifted. There's just so many repercussions of what's happening in the economy. People are struggling. If they lose their housing, we are in no way equipped to handle. We were already operating above our typical capacity before this hit. So I think everyone on this call is probably well aware of the shortage of affordable housing in our state. So this situation could certainly exacerbate that, and the emergency shelter providers are already operating at maximum capacity. So I really appreciate this opportunity to share with you the impact of the pandemic as it relates to our organization and the population that we serve, along with our responses thus far. So thank you so much.
Your next speaker, Kathleen, is that Nikki Clark? Someone from the Capital Center in Concord with us?
Yes, this is Nikki. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Thank you.
Okay.
Go
thank
ahead.
Thank you. This is Nikki Clark. I'm the Executive Director of the Capital Center for the Arts, and I am honored to speak with you today, as I feel so keenly the weight of the calamity of that has hit the entire country and my little world of the nonprofit art sector of New Hampshire. In this allotted time, I'm going to use the story of the Capital Center for the Arts to highlight the role the arts play in the vitality and economy of New Hampshire communities. Right now, the downtowns in every town and city in New Hampshire is dark. Its residents are at home. Its retail establishments, theaters, galleries, concert halls are shuttered. The arts community can and should be part of the recovery. We can help towns and cities rebound from this crisis. We are needed to lift spirits, bring hope, inspire dreams, and rebuild community. We are ready to serve, but we need some financial investment so that we can not only serve our community short term, but survive in the long term. To set the stage for my story, I want to provide just a bit of context for the structure of the creative economy. The arts and culture industry in the U.S. is big. You might be surprised to know that it is larger than the construction and transportation sectors, made up both of for-profit and non-profit businesses, which are connected through a complex, multi-layered ecosystem. At the core of both parts of this world is the creative artist, who devotes his or her life to enriching the lives of others through art, song, dance, theater, literature, or other disciplines. What distinguishes the nonprofit art field, however, is its business model and its commitment to serving the whole community. For the past 35 years, nonprofit arts organizations have grown across the country and New Hampshire, creating spaces for audiences and artists to come together to be inspired and learn and celebrate what we share together and the ways that we are different from each other. And at times, these organizations these organizations have breathed significant economic life back into neighborhoods and downtowns, becoming these engines of economic development. That is the story of the Capital Center for the Arts, the small group of dreamers in Concord who believes that a 1927 old movie palace could have a new life as a nonprofit performing arts center were right. Over its 24-year history, the CCA has grown into a $3.5 million operation with over 200 events per year attended by over 100,000 visitors. Approximately 70% of the revenues are generated through show and community rental events. These might ticket fees, sales, rentals. So 30% of our revenues are contributions from businesses, individuals, and some grants. Only 0.4% is from government funding. Through a 2016 Regional Arts Economic Impact Study, we know that Concord area patrons spend an average of $18 in the community above and beyond the price of admission when they are at an arts event. They go out to dinner. They spend money in shops. They are there. Patrons who travel from communities greater than Concord spend an additional $49 per person. That audience makeup is typically 60% local and 40% non-local. The same study showed that the combined economic impact of the 15 nonprofit organizations in this region totaled $31 million. And at this point, this impact has been abruptly upended with the onslaught of this crisis. In the early years of the CCA, shows and community events brought people and life to this depressed South Main Street neighborhood. Having an anchor organization at that end of town inspired two major developers to build three multi-use office buildings. These facilities also held the nonprofit Indie Red River Movie Theater and Gibson's Independent Bookstore. The momentum generated by this development continued with a complete redesign of Main Street, which spurred additional growth with several new shops, restaurants, and a boutique hotel. This transformation culminated with the CCA creating a second small, flexible venue with a $6.9 million rehabilitation of the former Concord Theater. This created jobs and industry, and has benefited the entire community. The Bank of New Hampshire stage opened to rave reviews in June 2019, and the CCA was on track, serving the music interests of younger residents in the area and growing ticket sales by another 20,000 until the pandemic wiped out the performing arts tourism industry. Between March 9th and 13th, the entire CCA's spring season of over 35 shows and events was canceled or rescheduled, resulting in a $700,000 loss of revenue. In addition, ticket sales have totally dried up. May and June, historically the big sales months for the new season that starts in the fall, the inability to put any season on sale is pointing to another $500,000 loss, and these funds usually provide the cash flow for the CCA to get through the summer months. We have responded quickly to this dynamic situation. All 21 occasional part-time staff were laid off. 21 full and permanent part-time staff were placed in a workshare program through May 2nd, when we will move to a skeleton crew of 8 through the summer. But here is our dilemma. We do not know when we will be allowed to reopen and under what conditions. We do not know if we will be economically viable if we are required to operate at reduced occupancy capacities. We do not know if national touring shows will have enough dates to be viable if they are still hot spots of COVID-19 across the country. We do not know if patients will feel safe enough to come out to shows. These unknowns are dizzying and making planning very challenging. Wounded though we are running multiple scenarios and financial forecasting while looking for opportunities to deliver programs in new ways. You can be rest assured every other nonprofit arts organization is doing the same, and we are all committed to be as creative, flexible, and as nimble as we can be. However, in the long run, we cannot sacrifice the very core of our mission, our commitment to bringing people together to experience live performances with artists and each other in real time and space. That is the center of who we are, and here is why this matters. On the other side of this health crisis, we are going to need to build trust and strengthen community bonds to repair the social fabric of our neighborhoods and our nation. Live arts performances and creative arts participation will be critical tools to bring to that challenge. We ask you to please invest in the CCA and the other New Hampshire arts nonprofits so that we can be there, so we can do our part to make us whole again. Thank you.
Thank you, Nikki. Kathleen, I think that's either back to you or Mr. Ober.
Commissioner Little, this is Dick Ober. We have maybe about five more minutes of remarks, and then we'll want to make sure we reserve some time for questions. Does that sound right to you?
Sounds perfect. Thank you, sir.
Great. So I'd like to say a word about charitable giving, as it's come up so many times. Donations from individuals and foundations and businesses are obviously critical for the nonprofit sector, but of course in a down economy, charitable giving is also down. Just as an example, after the 2008 crash, giving dropped by around 25%, and in New Hampshire, that represented a loss of about $100 million for the charitable sector, and it stayed down for years. The decline this time is likely to be deeper and last a lot longer. And when it comes to organized philanthropy, you take all the New Hampshire-based foundations and the United Ways together, and our annual output to New Hampshire organizations is about $70 million a year. It makes a huge difference, but it's just nowhere near enough. So what does all this mean for the Coronavirus Relief Fund? We have just a couple of thoughts for you to consider. First of all, nonprofit organizations are public charities. Everything that we do is in the public interest and transparent to the public. That's required by federal and state law. It's regulated by the Charitable Trust Division in the Department of Justice. Nonprofits file annual reports with the state and Form 990 tax returns with the IRS. We're governed by volunteer boards of community leaders who have significant fiduciary obligations of oversight, and we're staffed by experienced professionals. So this sector stands ready to help. So the question is, how could the nonprofit sector be mobilized to help pull New Hampshire through this crisis and mitigate the impacts of COVID-19 with investments from the CRF? I'm going to suggest a programmatic approach to this and then a strategic approach. Programmatic, this is just an example. It's clear that the coronavirus is disproportionately affecting low-income and other marginalized and vulnerable residents. So, for example, let's just suppose for a moment that $400 million were available in a special fund for nonprofits to address the impact of COVID-19. You might dedicate a significant portion of that to cover the expenses of nonprofits who are serving vulnerable residents who are most immediately affected by the public health and the economic impacts of COVID-19. And that could include the nonprofit share of testing and contact tracing to increase public safety and to keep the curve down. You could then set aside another portion. That's the immediate, short-term, public health, and economic impacts felt by residents in every community in the state, nonprofits are serving those people. You could set aside another portion to nonprofits who can help communities mitigate the longer-term economic and social impacts and help restore economic and civic vitality. In that first category would include food kitchens, homeless shelters, community health centers, child care providers, family resource centers, the youth serving agencies, organizations that serve victims of domestic violence, organizations that serve refugees and immigrants, other populations, others of our neighbors who are being most directly affected on the short term. In the second category would be arts organizations like the Capitol Center and museums that drive economic activity on Main Street, conservation organizations that provide safe outdoor places for people to recreate. All the conservation areas in the state actually are seeing a lot of people visiting them as they're looking to get outside. It could include nonprofit news services that deliver timely and, frankly, life-saving information about COVID-19. It could include civic organizations that unite people and businesses across difference to find solutions. So in both of those categories, both the immediate, short-term, and the somewhat longer-term impacts created by COVID-19, the vast majority of those groups are small and mid-sized, say budgets of $50,000 to $10 million. Those groups find it really hard to access other sources of public funding. So a portion of the total fund reserved for those purposes would have enormous public benefit. And then finally, strategically, we think you could take maximum advantage and should of existing nonprofit networks and platforms to maximize the effectiveness, the efficiency, and the collaboration that these funds could support. Nonprofits are really good at working together to achieve more. It's kind of a culture born of necessity. We'd urge you not to reinvent systems that are already in place. Those networks and those coalitions exist across all of the subsectors within the nonprofits. And then, of course, there are organizations that know the sector really well and have systems and platforms to identify need and to help direct resources to meet that need. Those include the Center for Nonprofits, Kathleen's organizations, the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, other foundations, the United Ways, community development finance institutions. Those organizations work really closely together also, and we think could be enormously helpful. So you have an enormous task of advising on your hands. These are opening ideas. Unprecedented crisis, of course, with many complex and interrelated impacts on the sector. Investments from the fund are needed and could have huge public benefits through the nonprofit sector. We stand ready to help and, of course, welcome any questions either now or later. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dick. Representative Wallner, we have you down for our first question. And just a reminder to other folks that if you'd like to ask a question, if you would hit 5-star on the keypad, we'll get a little notice on our computer screen to let us know that you're waiting to ask. Representative Wallner.
Thank you. Mr. Ober sort of addressed what I was wondering how we could go, what we could do for nonprofits, how we could organize a way of getting out funds to nonprofits. And I guess I heard him talking about a large amount of money that would be set aside for nonprofits. How do you see that being administered? Where would that? How would you see that that is happening? Who would you see as administering it? and setting up the criteria for nonprofits.
Thank you, Representative Wallner. I'm not sure, to be fair. I think rather than think of exactly where, maybe some principles, a fund like that would need to be overseen with great integrity, transparency. You would want to make sure that there is rationale and methodology to moving the funds to the greatest need that is created from the impacts of the crisis. You would want to set up a way both for those funds to be moved efficiently, transparently, but also to have a process so nonprofits many of whom are relatively invisible to kind of on the statewide, but as we know, are just deeply embedded in the community, so an inclusive process so nonprofits could explain exactly what they were doing and have a chance to access those funds. There are existing organizations who could put their heads together, I know, and come up with some potential models with obviously the appropriate level of oversight and direction from public decision makers.
Thank you. I guess another question I would have is, do you think that there are ways that we can get this? I assume some nonprofits are probably just right now just hanging on by a thread because this has hit them very hard, but yet, as you mentioned, they still had a lot of service they needed to provide. Do you think there's a way we can get these funds out there to those, particularly those organizations, in a really timely manner? There may be two sets of funding here. One to get out for the immediate need, and then one fund that would be for a longer term.
Yes, that was that approach that that Kathleen and several other people who we consulted before this call thought might be one way to do that.
Thank you.
Further questions for either Kathleen or Mr. Ober or either of the folks they have on the line with them? Seeing none, I do thank you very much, everybody, and we'll be moving momentarily to our second presentation, which will be Higher Education, Chancellor Todd Leach, and Executive Director Debbie Seary. Is this a follow-up question? Just a quick message out to Speaker Shurtleff. I understand you might have switched to a different phone line. If you could hit 5-star, it would appear on the computer screen and we could identify you so we could clear you to speak when you have a question. So hearing no further questions at the moment, let's move to the next segment, which is Effect on Higher Education. We have with us, I believe, on the line right now, University System of New Hampshire Chancellor Todd Leach and New Hampshire College and University Compact Executive Director Debbie Seary. Chancellor Leach, are you there?
I am. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What would you like to say to us?
Well, first of all, thank you for the time to speak to the group. I want to thank the advisory board members and new Chair Little and other members of the advisory board. A couple of things I want to just highlight very quickly, which is the role that we have played as a system to help stand up some capacity, surge capacity across the state to help support the state in this crisis. Every one of our residential campuses has set up a surge capacity there. We've also been using our maker spaces to create PPE, and including ventilator parts and other things that we've been able to do to help support the state in this time. The other thing that I think is really important just to make you aware of before we get to what our request is that we have certainly been hit pretty hard in terms of our revenues this year alone. We refunded to students $41.6 million for room and board and other fees, which is lost revenue, of course, will not get back. But it was something that we felt was the right thing to do for our students and their parents and families, just instead of providing some kind of credit, really trying to provide the dollars in their pocket that they could use in this particularly difficult and challenging time. As we look ahead, we're anticipating even more significant hits. We are planning to try to have things prepared so we can open in the fall. But at the same time, if we are out again for a half a semester or a full semester in a remote model, that's about an $84 million lost revenue in room and board. We're also going to look at tuition in terms of the impacts there, perhaps $20 to $100 million that we'll have. So I just wanted to make the advisory board aware of the significant financial hits that we've had. We obviously have been a big economic engine for the state. We generate about $2 billion a year in revenue for the state, have an impact of $2 billion a year. And we're really looking to help the state when we get to the point where we can start building things back up and know our role will be critical in an economic recovery. Having said all of that, there's three things that we're particularly focused on in terms of federal aid that might be able to assist us and assist our ability to support the state. One is testing ability for all of our students and staff to be able to return to campus. I think in the absence of a vaccine, which nobody's expecting for the fall, the only way we get students and faculty and staff back is if we have a robust testing capability in place. We've been working with hospitals trying to get an estimate of that cost. We know that the test kits alone would be about $1 million expense, but we're looking at the staff to support that testing that would be required and the cleaning of the facilities and so forth that would be required around that would be somewhere between that $1 million test-only cost estimate to about $5 million. And that's one thing that is going to be really important if we're going to be able to bring students back to these communities and help support those local economies, is to be able to ensure that we have taken the steps to ensure their safety. The second major change for us is another one-time ask as we're looking at how to better stand up a remote delivery capability in the event that we have to be remote at some point next year. It could be in the fall. It could be that there's a second wave that hits in the spring that we have to go remote on. And while I think our faculty did a spectacular job just standing up what they did in the matter of days, to prepare for the remainder of this semester. There's a lot that has to happen for that experience to be at the level where we can comfortably ensure students will return and that students will get the same, will meet their expectations. So that's going to, for us, involve an investment, one, in classroom technology. So if we look at our classes and equip those so that we have a ability to do a remote delivery simultaneous with our classes. We're looking at outfitting about 50% of our classes across the system, and that would be at a cost of about $6 million. But what that would do would be allow us to open in the fall, or more likely open in the fall, and be able to assure students that didn't feel comfortable they could get the same learning through the remote learning, or if students were to become sick during the course of the semester and were in quarantine, they wouldn't have their studies disrupted, and that we could have this capability to really stand up a different model for the long term. I know we heard the governor yesterday responding to a question about needing really to build up this kind of remote and distance capability. We think it's important as well, and we think it's going to be really important to assuring students and getting them back, as well as to deal with the contingencies that might happen, and just to have a more robust online delivery in general. That would also require a good deal of training. So in addition to the technology, we're looking at investing in both faculty training as well as an instructional design capability, so that we could have a long-term shift in some of what we deliver and how we do it. And then finally, one last thing I'd like to mention, and I'm happy to answer any questions on any of these, is that we have continued with our tuition freeze, as we had announced before that the state partnered with us around. We want to continue that. But we had also launched something called the Granite Guarantee, which was essentially a tuition-free path for students who were Pell eligible in need of finances. And I don't know the extent to which there might be the ability to apply federal dollars here, but we would like to be able to expand that Granite Guarantee to a larger group of students and families, given the economic hardships that so many of them are feeling for the the upcoming year in the fall term. So those are the areas we're obviously appreciative of anything that helps us with the revenue shortfalls, but also understand that there's limits on how those federal dollars can be used. And we think the both the testing and the ability to stand up remote capability are directly related to the COVID crisis and our ability to get this economic engine moving again.
Thank you, Chancellor. Dr. Siri, are you with us?
I don't know that Dr. Siri, this is Michelle Perkins. I'm the chair of the New Hampshire College University Council, and I was told I was expected to speak, so here I am.
Yes, I'm sorry. You're absolutely correct. My apologies.
Oh, that's okay. That's
go right
okay.
ahead.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon. I'm Dr. Michelle Perkins. I'm the president of New England College and also the chair of New Hampshire College and University Council, which is comprised, the membership is comprised of all of the NEAS accredited nonprofit institutions in the state, public and private. And so thank you very much for the opportunity to speak before this committee to share the impact of COVID-19 on the higher education community. And much of what I'm going to say, Todd Leach has also just said as well, so some of it is repetitive, but I don't know that we can say it too much. So I'm saying this representing all the colleges, including the private. New Hampshire institutions of higher education are confronting unprecedented challenges, as you know, as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. And the challenges have led to serious financial damages that threaten the entire education, higher education community, including New Hampshire's public and private 2- and 4-year institutions. No one has immunity from this virus. A national coalition of higher education associations has described the crisis by asserting that students are struggling to adjust to rapid changes in their families' financial circumstances, while institutions are grappling with closed campuses, wholesale shifts in how they teach, and the unanticipated expenses that arise from serving their students safely during this pandemic. The CARES Act was a very important step toward ensuring students, especially the most vulnerable, have their basic needs addressed. Similarly, federal funds to support colleges and universities will help keep institutions operating, but even with these, many of us will have budget deficits for this year and great uncertainty for the next academic year and beyond. We are grateful for the CARES Act, but truly the amount of money provided for students in higher education in the CARES Act does not come close to filling the gap. As Moody's has reported, the total support to institutions provided in CARES will only equal about 1% of total university expenditures and higher education continues to face significant financial challenges into fiscal year 2021, including potential losses of revenue from tuition, state funding, endowment income, and gifts. Students and schools will have fewer resources and greater need. This is a crisis of unprecedented proportions, as we all know. The pandemic is striking during the height of the admissions process for incoming students and the peak of registration for returning students, and the requirement to close physical campuses for extended periods, along with justifiable concerns among current and prospective students about when and if to return to campus are cause for concern. For these reasons, college and university leaders are preparing for significant, potentially unparalleled declines in enrollment, both from students who do not come back and those who never start. And as we all know, higher education plays a vital role in the economic health of our state. In addition to providing direct economic benefits through operating activities, New Hampshire's college and universities educate and train our state's workforce, both current and future, on research, facilitate entrepreneurship, enrich the state, work with communities around the state, and offer an array of cultural and recreational experiences for all. Our operating budget in New Hampshire collectively account for $2.8 billion, and our students in New Hampshire serve communities in volunteer hours to total 5 million hours annually. The NHCUC's most recent economic impact study conducted several years ago showed an overall impact of $8.1 billion in the state. In small towns like mine, Kenneker, the college is the largest employer by far and the largest property taxpayer. Our college conducted its own economic impact study in 2018 and showed an overall impact of $161 million per year. Colleges, particularly private colleges, are businesses, not-for-profit businesses whose primary mission is to serve public good, but massive losses in revenues for room and board, for instance, which cannot be covered in the first wave of CARES funding, can have devastating impact, as Todd has just also mentioned. Schools that do not have billion-dollar endowments, and that's the vast majority of colleges and universities, rely on revenues from tuition and various income streams to remain solvent. If an institution runs out of cash, it can't make payroll, and then it most likely will close. This crisis has the potential to cause the demise of many great institutions of higher learning across the country, and those states that can preserve their institutions will be an advantage in terms of workforce development when this crisis is over. We've had a number of conversations with the members of the New Hampshire College and University Council, and we prepared an estimate that suggests our collective institutions have lost more than $185 million so far this year. And it's a conservative estimate, and it doesn't really capture some of the big unknowns, and that is, as Todd has mentioned, will we be able to open in the fall? Even if New Hampshire colleges can open the fall, the National Higher Education Associations are estimating that enrollments across the country will drop by 15% and international student enrollment by 25%. We anticipate similar trends in our state. Just to recap the losses of this year so far from a survey we did of our membership, $65 million loss so far this year, including but not limited to student fees. $60 million potential refunds due to students. That's when we sent them home when the crisis began. $50 million in increased medical costs, pay leave for employees not able to work remotely, lost contract income, et cetera. $7 million to move classes online for remote learning, technology training, et cetera. $3 million on emergency expenses for students such as housing, including transportation. So what emergency relief is needed, and there's a wide range of opportunities and needs in terms of grant and tuition aid for students. And as we all know, New Hampshire is ranked at the bottom for tuition aid for students in the country, and therefore being able to provide some grant aid for students would make it much more likely that families could afford to attend next year. Or zero interest loan program for students. Many students will require emergency funds for tuition, and this would be a great help. And for institutions, access to affordable capital a necessary lifeline for institutions and the communities they serve if we are to weather the storm and return to normal operations. This will otherwise allow otherwise financially stable institutions to access zero interest loans to replace short-term revenue disruption. The infusion of capital will enable institutions to remain solvent until the virus recedes and normal operations can resume. And then, of course, as Todd had mentioned as well, the resources that will be needed for COVID-19 testing. Whatever normal is in the coming months, it will be a new normal, and we will need to ensure that our communities are safe, and so resources are needed to keep students, faculty, and staff safe as we reopen and hope for expanded testing capacity. So to conclude, for everyone in the state and this country, the only certainty regarding this pandemic is uncertainty, and we're hopeful that we will be able to open for a fall semester. But sadly, already institutions in some urban areas are planning for another semester that will be conducted virtually or online. We hope that's not the case for us in September. We monitor this problem regularly and are in the process of gathering additional data. And, of course, we will be happy to share all of that with this group. So, again, thank you for this opportunity, and I'm also happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Perkins. So we'll take a minute now for the members of the committee to hit 5-star to have questions presented to either Chancellor Leach or Dr. Perkins. Do we have any questions for Chancellor Leach or Dr. Perkins? I don't see any at the moment, but if someone comes up with a question, please just hit 5-star and it will pop up on our computer screen here. Senator D'Alessandro, you have a question for us, sir. Please hit 5-star. Go ahead, Senator D'Alessandro. You may be on mute, Senator D'Alessandro.
New Hampshire is unique in this way, Jerry. Private institutions pay property tax, and I know that we have had numerous requests from the big businesses about abating property tax. I'd like to ask President Perkins, what's the property tax bill for her in Henneka? And I know St. Anselm's is the largest property taxpayer in Goffstown, and I don't know what Colby Sawyer is or Franklin Pierce is, but that's an unusual situation. Most post-secondary institutions pay in lieu of a tax. And so if President Perkins could reply to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator D'Alessandro. I used to have this exact figure in my head, but, of course, we also have a campus in Manchester now, following the merger of the New Hampshire Institute of Art into New England College. But I checked with our CFO the other day. I believe it's over $400,000 a year.
And I would just add that while the university system does not pay property taxes, we do have a number of paying in lieu of arrangements at our residential campuses.
Thank you. Further questions for our representatives from higher education? All right. Hearing none or seeing none on the computer screen, thank you both very much. Thank you, Chancellor Leach. Thank you, Dr. Perkins, for your presentations. And so I will give a quick heads up to our next speakers, who will be James Key Wallace of the Business Finance Authority and Catherine Easterly from the CDFA. We're going to we'll bring you in about 10 minutes, I think, which makes this a good time for us to have a conversation with members of the Legislative Advisory Committee. We have been very busy setting up agendas for next Monday, next Wednesday, and we're currently populating a list for next Friday as well to continue hearing from people from various sectors of the economy and society from all across the state of New Hampshire. But at some point, we need to request that this group pivot from spending all of their time receiving public testimony to providing input to the Gopher office that can be passed along to Governor Sununu in the form of spending recommendations. I know that you are anxious, as is the governor, to start sending the CARES Act funds out to a wide variety of entities so we can put them to work in the street. And so the request I have for you today is to think about the right time for making that pivot so that we start to spend more time discussing how you would like to see the funds spent, but also to ask you to think about, to help us with our process, if you could identify 8 to 10 large categories or sectors, much as we've been doing healthcare, education, nonprofits, hospitality, business generally, and think about what subcategories would come under those larger groupings. We're going through a similar process here at the Gopher office, and we are hopeful that your work will either confirm ours or tell us that we need to look in other directions. So if sometime in the coming week we can have that conversation about what you believe are the major sectors that we need to be identifying for receipt of the CARES Act funds. And if you want to get to the point where you're looking at even subgroups under healthcare, we've talked to hospitals and we've talked to nonprofits that deliver healthcare to low-income people in their communities. And we're going to talk next week to doctors and dentists and eye doctors and pharmacists. That would be helpful as well. And then to drill down even a little bit further, to ask you if you might put some weight to the, I hate to use the word importance, but maybe the immediacy of the need at each of these. What we have, I think, come to hear in the past 2 weeks is that while $1.24 billion is an awful lot of money, it's not enough to meet even the requests that we've heard from various segments so far this week. So we're going to have to focus on needs, not wants, and immediate needs, and where we think we'll get the biggest bang for the buck that we have to spread. So we do have a couple of questions now at this point. I believe Representative Wallner has a question.
Thank you, Director Little. I would like to try to get sort of a feel for where we are as to how many funds have already been expended by the state, particularly around, I know we've had many, many state employees working on COVID-related work items, and I wonder if we could get sort of an accounting of that. Also, I do know that the paid family leave provided to state employees for COVID-19 illness, if we could get an accounting of that, I assume that those are all areas that can be, this fund can be used for. And then if we could sort of get an update of the chart that you provided us on April 15th, you provided us with a chart of what has already been expended. I think there were things like the fund for health care and hospitals, a number of other items that the governor had allowed to go forward. If you could get sort of an accounting of how much we are already committed, that would really be helpful, at least to me, to have
sure.
that kind of information. Okay?
Absolutely. We had a request from, I believe Senator Morse made the request last week or the week before, that we double back to all of the state agencies that spoke to us during our very first conference call to essentially ask your first question, Representative Wallner, what sorts of expenses have they incurred that they believe should be or potentially be recoverable from the CARES Act money. Some of those agencies took a little bit longer than we had hoped. We had asked them all to have their data back to us by Tuesday of this week. I think we got the last of them in yesterday, and we have someone downstairs in the other office that is putting that report together. So we should be able to provide that to you. We can ask the question about how much paid family leave has been expended by the state to support state employees during this time, and you'd like the governor's office to update the chart that they provided to you last week of showing the other expenses that that they've made so far. Did I get those all correct?
Yes, you did. Thank you, Mr. Lillard. I just have one other item that I'm trying to follow up on. We had information that there were 12 sites set up around the state that were going to be basically surge centers. They were set up in many different communities. And I had asked us if we could have an accounting of how those were paid for. And I would wonder if those are also part of something that can be reimbursed by the state.
Okay, got it. Yep. Thank you. I remember the request, and I apologize. I did not follow up on that. That's on me. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Whenever possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Morse, you have a question, sir.
Well, I have a couple of things. The first of all, I have a list of requests for additional presentations, which I've been doing on this call, so I'll give that to you right now. One was child care. Two was emergency responders, and it was thought best that maybe Paul Parisi could coordinate that one. And then the third one was definitely pointed towards agriculture. I don't know if it's just agriculture, but, you know, it may include farmers and things like that. But those are the three requests that I have, unless I missed something that went to spam again. But just so you have those. I'd just like to comment on your request. I think, you know, as early as the beginning of the week next week, we should all be coming up with concepts at a very high level of those 8 to 10 that you just asked about. I think that one of the things that you could probably do is the elimination side of it. I know some of us were on a call with hospitals, and when we get done with that call, we said the reality is this is $1.2 billion, and we should only be dealing with March and April, even though this money goes from March 1st to December for this year. Let's look at that picture with the hospitals right now, because there's a big what if things start to open, because that certainly came into that conversation. You know, at what point do you break even if things start to open? And so I don't know that we have to be thinking a year out, like some of the presenters had already talked about today, because some of us were on a call today with on the federal side, and they're certainly thinking in Washington about starting things back up. You know, where's the funding going to come for that? I think those are all different models, to be honest with you. I think, one, we're talking about what people had to use for COVID response today, and then we have a whole other model about bringing society back up to speed. I think if we started to have a conversation at the beginning of the week about how people are looking at that, it would shape our debate on what to tell the governor we're thinking is a response. I mean, I've heard all kinds of things, to be honest with you. I mean, I've heard people coming up with concepts of different buckets to put it in that would be much better at, you know, accountability. Maybe different buckets is an answer. I don't know the answer to this, but I think as we're thinking over the weekend and we're all getting responses from different groups, I think this will narrow itself down very quickly when every organization is asking for, you know, 180, 400, 700 million. that doesn't exist. So we have to think about how we best can affect what's happening today. And I love long-term thinking, but I don't think there's enough money here to do that. So just an opinion.
Thank you, Senator. Senator D'Alessandro, do you have a comment or question, sir? Alessandro, you have your hand up. Would you like to make a comment or ask a question?
Yep. Are you all set?
Yes, we have you. Yeah. Yes,
okay.
You are, sir.
Oh, thank you. Just a couple of quickies. With Washington currently discussing changes in how this money can be spent, we should think about short-term spend and hold for the long term as to recognizing what those changes will be. I think that's extremely, extremely important, because we know the asks are quite high right across the board, but I think we've got to be judicious. That's why I think it's so important that we have a legal opinion on what we can spend this money on presently. And if changes come, that would expand the universe in terms of how monies could be spent. Again, based on conversations that we've had on other calls, there seems to be an appetite to do more in subsequent months with regard to the recovery part of this. That's another very important issue as it relates to long term. So I think we have two very distinct problems. What do we do in the immediate term, the short term? What do we do in conjunction with the recovery and how we move to a quote-unquote normal situation for our state? And I think Senator McConnell's nonsense that states and cities should declare bankruptcy is unproductive in this discussion. We got to think about how we can move forward and how the federal government can support us in moving in And lastly, to Mary Jane Walden's comments, we've got to know how much of this corpus has been already expended. And we had two documents that were given to us early on that indicated that about $125 million had been allocated. Now, how much of that is covered by the $125 billion, and how much is left as we go forward? The last thing is the FEMA money. I know communities are now concerned about the FEMA money, and there was some request put forth by New Hampshire that 100% should be covered by FEMA. Now, Perry Plummer put that request in. I wonder what kind of an answer he's received from the federal government. That would certainly aid us in our thought process. Thank you.
Speaker Sherliff, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me, Jerry?
Yes, I can, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, I've had a revelation. In the town of Bethlehem, if you sit near a window, you'll get far stronger cell service than is if you sit in the interior of the room. And now for my two comments. First of all, Jerry, do either you or the governor's office have a time that you're looking at for us to get our recommendations into you?
I don't have a deadline, but yeah. I would like us to talk about, as I sort of mentioned, discuss as a group making a pivot. At some point, so we've received a lot of very compelling testimony. We can see that the situation is extremely serious across the state in all sectors. But we're, I think, approaching a point where we need to move to spending more of our time focusing on how do we want to recommend that the governor distribute the funds so we can get them out into the communities. I don't have a deadline. I don't have a time. I do think that we should shoot for trying to distribute monies beginning in the month of May. I also think that the D'Alessandro makes some good points. If the feds are going to change the rules, if they're determining that the 3.5 pages of guidance they gave us on Wednesday evening are too restrictive, it would be good to have funds still available to use under those new and improved rules if they ever come out. But we also have to balance that against the needs that are in the communities today, and that's why I think to have the conversation about identifying sectors and then weighting them about what are the urgent current needs so we can try to address some of those, and then holding some funds in abeyance, keeping in mind that we have to spend them all no later than December 31st of this year. They have to be out of the account by the end of this calendar year or they go back to the federal government. So long answer to your simple question, do I have a deadline? I do not, but we have a lot of dynamics we need to make work all well together.
Thanks, Jerry. The second part of my question I had is Senator Morse, I think, mentioned at one of our meetings that we should hold some money back in reserve. And now I know Dr. Fauci is saying that the coronavirus may return this fall or this winter. And I wondered if this group, when we finish this round of work, instead of adjourning, if we should recess and look maybe coming back to October and keeping some money in reserve in the event that we see the pandemic returning, that we can put it where it may most be needed.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Senator Reagan, and by the way, just a quick heads up to James Key Wallace and Catherine Easterly from BFA and CDFA, we realize we're stepping on your time, but we're not going to take any of it away from you. We still have the half hour that we've allotted after this. These questions we take. We're going to hear from Senator Reagan now, followed by a follow-up question from Senator Morse, I believe. So, Senator Reagan.
Thanks, Jerry. I am curious about how an insurance adjuster would apportion some of these business losses that had business interruption insurance. I mean, what's their criteria? What do they feel that it's justified to pay and what to not pay for so that we have some idea, because we have these tens of millions of dollars numbers, and like the hospital people had this fantasy of losing $20 million a day or a week or whatever it was, and then we find out it was just that they hadn't billed that much. So I'd like to know how the insurance industry that deals with losses, how they apportion the proceeds of a policy. So if you can find somebody, if the insurance department can find an adjuster to talk to us.
Thank you, Senator Reagan. We'll reach out to them. And finally, Senator Morse, and then we'll move, after that, we'll move on to the BFA and CDFA. Senator Morse?
Yeah, just a comment to Speaker Shurtleff. I don't see how we go away before your office goes away, but I believe that'll be up to the governor because we may not have to meet as frequent as we're meeting now because this is a tough schedule for a lot of people. But I think the reality is if your office exists, I think we have to exist.
Thank you. Makes sense.
Thank you, and thank you to James Key Wallace and Catherine Easterly for your patience. I apologize, we're about 10 minutes late getting to you. You were originally scheduled to go from 2:30 to 3. How about if we make that from 2:40 to 3:10? And why don't you take it away, James?
Great. Thank you, Jerry. Can you hear me all right?
We hear you fine. Thank you.
Perfect. So with your permission, I'd like to actually invite Katie to start first for 10 minutes, and then the BFA would go for about 10 minutes, and then reserve the remainder of the time for questions.
Sounds good. Katie? You may need to hit 5-star, Katie, so we can make sure your phone is unmuted. Or James, maybe you might need to go, and we can see if we can get Katie to call in.
Okay. Yep. That's no problem at all. Well, good afternoon, everybody. For the record, I'm James Key Wallace. I'm the Executive Director of the Business Finance Authority. For those of you that don't know, we are a statewide agency created in 1992, actually in an era not dissimilar to this in, you know, for different reasons, but we were created back during the banking and savings and loans crisis to help ensure that New Hampshire businesses and nonprofits have capital and have access to capital, whether they need it as temporary capital or long-term capital to grow and create employment. So we primarily work by helping the banking system deliver loans to their clients by a series of programs that can help a bank make a loan that they believe in or doesn't fit the box within the bank to get that sort of no / maybe into a yes. And then we have a variety of programs to provide direct loans to companies under special certain circumstances. Everything is with the goal of making employment in the state, recognizing that there's a significant public benefit to strong employment. A healthy economy produces all the tax revenue, whether it's jobs for people so they can pay their property taxes or business taxes or meals and rooms taxes. You know, all of that revenue is what makes all the good work and programs be in the state possible. So I'll start very quickly just to say what have we seen out there on the lending front and also on the economic front. Recognizing you've already heard testimony from different groups, so I won't repeat their testimony. In essence, it's very difficult across all sectors in the New Hampshire economy. There are a few, bright spots, but they're few and far between. The hardest hit sectors are clearly hospitality, restaurants, local retail, you know, anything that thrives off of foot traffic is really, really depressed right now. As you heard earlier, we're also seeing our nonprofit organizations really being stretched. And so our goal is to help firms not go out of business and not be so badly damaged that when the recovery does happen, they're able to quickly rehire, ramp back up, and you know, promote a robust recovery. It's a lot harder to restart a business, to start over, than it is to resume an existing one, even if it's temporarily shut down. So, you know, our goal is to help the New Hampshire economy sort of bend, but not break during this time. So, you know, what we have and what we've shared with the group is what our proposal would be to support businesses and nonprofits across the state. You know, essentially what we've seen out there is the banks have done a pretty good job in delivering the PPP program to small businesses and nonprofits across the state. However, for every success story, there are probably many times that frustrations where people were locked out of the programs or funds ran out or they weren't eligible. In the past few weeks alone, we've received requests from over 150 businesses and nonprofits who need help. The immediate capital requests are in excess of $45 million. It grows every day. And this is from people who have either already received help from the SBA or in many cases just aren't eligible or couldn't get there. We've heard testimony that the need could be much larger, you know, several hundred million. In response to that, we crafted a framework for the group to consider, which I'll go into in a moment. So, you know, from the BFA's perspective, I just want to give you a little bit about us. So we have a set of existing ready-to-go programs since 1992. We have been a conduit for federal funds, just, you know, relief funds similar to the CARES Act funds in the past. During the 2008 to 2012 financial meltdown, there was a significant amount of federal money funneled through the states called SSBCI. Jerry, I'm sure you remember it all too well. That stood for the State Small Business Credit Initiative. It was federal relief money designed to get in the hands of local small business in New Hampshire to help them through what at that time was a financial crisis that was no fault of their own, and yet they were being locked out of the credit markets. That was delivered through the BFA. With great success. We helped a lot of companies. There were extensive guidelines about how the money could be used, under what circumstances, extensive reporting requirements. It was complex. There were mandatory audits by the Federal Office of Inspector General, and we went through that audit process. It was about a two-year process. At the time ours was completed, they had finished about half the states, and proud to say New Hampshire at the time was, I believe, the only state that had we had a 100% compliance with all those federal guidelines. So these types of processes, crisis response, economic response, being a conduit for federal funds, it's something the BFA is used to doing and has seen before, and we have existing programs and some new concepts for the group to consider to the degree that you want to allocate some of the CARES Act money toward small business support. So what I'd like to do is just go through the three components of what our vision for something like this would be. So the first component would be a $75 million package administered via the BFA for small businesses across the state. And this amount represents the existing pipeline of demand we've already seen, plus the minute that, you know, anyone says, hey, there's funding available, we're sure that new applications will, you know, exceed, you know, what we've already seen. So in order to be effective very quickly, and I also think get to the people that we want it to get to, which are those companies who are most affected by this crisis and those who have been most shut out of the other federal resources, we would deliver that through three main windows at the BFA. The first is the BFA's CAP program. So this is a program available to local New Hampshire businesses and nonprofits. It already exists. We've done over 5,000 loans in the state through this program. It works through the New Hampshire banking and credit union lending systems. And how it works is if you're a small business and or a nonprofit and you need $200,000 or less, right? Many of these are $10,000 loans, $50,000 loans, but $200,000 or less, and the bank wants to make you the loan, but they can't because you don't have enough collateral or you're in the middle of a coronavirus pandemic, something like that, any number of reasons. But they believe in you long term. The bank can enroll that loan in CAP. And when that happens, there's a special account set up at the bank by the BFA. The bank puts a small percentage of that loan in that account. The borrower puts a small percentage in that account. And the BFA matches that contribution 2.5 times to 1. So you end up with a small amount of money in that account. And every time a bank makes a CAP loan, that account gets a little bigger, a little bigger, a little bigger. And if a bank experiences a loss on any one of these loans in the CAP portfolio, the bank is able to cover their loss from that shared account. So that way they can say, hey, we built up this reserve, which is maintained as property of the BFA, but that reserve is there, and they can say, yep, we can use that as extra security to go make all these loans that we normally wouldn't be able to do. And so one of the beauties of that program is only a small percentage is being funded into that account because banks know most of their loans will work out. So we've contributed, you know, over the years, over $20 million in CAP funds into these accounts, but that's resulted in over $230 million in small nonprofit business lending. So for every dollar through the program, that turns into over $10 of lending into New Hampshire companies. And because of the size, it's really targeted to those smaller companies. So that's a really good program. It helps get to the folks we need to get to. But in today's environment, banks are understandably, they're very reticent to take risks beyond what they normally would. And so we need to contribute extra reserve funds into these CAP programs to help get banks lending to support these companies. So that's sort of one window in the first component. The second is our conventional loan guarantee program. I think there are a lot of knowledge out there about what the BFA does on our guarantee side. It's sort of what we're most known for. That is the bank, or if the BFA and the state can pledge guarantees to banks to help them make loans they normally couldn't. And these are any size loans. They're not limited to that $200,000 max. They tend to be equipment, real estate. But one of the challenges right now is a lot of the businesses that need lending support don't have the collateral in order to do it. You know, maybe they're a shop on Hampton Beach. Maybe they're a specialty service company. Maybe they're a nonprofit. We support Tri-County CAP, for example, up north. Maybe they're service-oriented and don't have hard assets. Our guarantee programs don't allow those to get made because of the lack of collateral. So with an infusion of capital for extra funds to act as reserves, we could broaden the types of companies that could get loans to help get through this crisis. And then the third, the BFA makes direct bridge loans. So, again, existing program, long track record, excellent repayment rate. You know, defaults have been, you know, less than, you know, 1% for many, many, many years since our inception. But we can make direct loans. And these are bridge loans to catch people who fall through the cracks of federal programs, state programs, and help just support these companies until conventional lending markets can step in. So the bridge loan program is what's seen a lot of requests of that $45 million in current requests that I talked about. Again, just because, you know, no one federal program can possibly service all the variety of needs that are out there. So based on the demand we see existing right now and what we anticipate would be created immediately after launch, we would say for a first pass at that, approximately $75 million would be required. So component two, so this is written in response to some of the testimony you heard earlier in the week about how local retail, hospitality, and restaurants were the groups most affected by this. I think that's true. This component two, I want to be careful. I don't want to pitch this as a BFA, endorsement of this strategy, but hearing our name brought up throughout the week and then hearing the amount that people were talking about, if the decision was made to allocate targeted industry relief funds for certain areas like the ones I mentioned, here's how we would suggest it get done. So, and here's how we would do it if we were the administrator. I think the big shortfall in what we've heard in some of the federal programs is those smaller companies not being able to access the funds while larger companies, you know, were first in line. And in fact, I think, as it appears, maybe sometimes organizations got the funds that didn't really need it. So we would want to, you know, make sure that doesn't happen here. And the primary method we do that, the method we use to do that, is by phasing the application process. So for this money, which I heard $700 million, $500 million, this document says $250 million, but in any case, you would phase the applications to say, okay, in phase one, the only people, these targeted industries who need $100,000 or less can apply. So it's small local companies who need small dollars of support. You get all those applications in the door, you see how much you have, you see how much is left in the allocated funding, and you say, okay. In phase two, people who need $250,000 or less, now you can apply. You get all those in the door, and you see how much is left, if any. And then in the third phase, you say, okay, you know, now anyone who feels they have a need can apply. And that way you make sure that the smaller companies get first crack at the financing. So we would recommend that applicants need to demonstrate that their business was viable prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, there are companies who sometimes, you know, were already on the edge or perhaps past the edge, and this sort of pushed them over. I don't know if that's exactly the target for these kind of funds. It appears to me that it would be those who were viable, doing well, and then the rug was pulled out from under them. So they would need to demonstrate they were viable. They would need to demonstrate they were actually affected by COVID-19 in a financial way and that they're using the funds for legitimate business purposes. We'd recommend that you put some restrictions on what these type of funds can be used for, what they can't be used for. Like, can't be used for excess owner's compensation, you know, can't go out the door for dividends and distributions, things like that. But other than that, you want to create a bad list of uses, but you want to not over-prescribe the allowable uses. So I think payroll's great, utilities, insurance costs, there's all these supplies, there's all these different kinds of uses of funds that the PPP program doesn't allow a business to spend money on, even though they're necessary for that business to survive. So you want to put some guardrails on it, but you don't want to over-restrict the business's ability to support itself with the money. The second piece of this is, for these targeted industries, I think the truth of the matter is, and based on what we've seen, they're not everyone's going to be able to borrow their way out of the crisis. So the loans made through this program would be up to 50% forgivable with a maximum forgiveness of $50,000. And the reason you do that is you want it half forgivable because you do want considerable skin in the game for any business who's participating. That's just how you prevent abuse of a public program. However, $50,000 of a forgivable loan, that's very meaningful to a local Main Street company, but it's not so large that a big corporation who wants millions of dollars is going to apply just to get $50,000 out of it. A mid-sized company who needs a $250,000 loan still gets some forgiveness, but proportionately less because it's $50,000 max. That way, the grant forgiveness is most targeted to those smaller companies who need it the most. And you can structure this in a way that makes sense to make sure that people are good actors. So if part of the loan was forgivable, part of it's not, you say, okay, well, once you've paid back the non-forgivable part, the rest of it's forgiven. If you default, it isn't. And that includes the requirement to provide any data, any reporting, all the transparency you need to comply with the federal reporting requirements. These loans be long-term, low interest rate, patient, flexible, just to work the way they need to support each business. So that's component two. Component three, I would put this in the camp. I heard some of the legislators on the advisory board talk about what would be longer term versus short term. Candidly, this component three, this is longer term. So this is entrepreneurship. I think we all know that despite the best efforts of everyone involved, some companies have already gone under or will go under as a result of this. Then there'll be an economic opportunity gap that needs to be filled on the back end of this. So new businesses will need to get started. Personal balance sheets are going to be wrecked. Risk capital is going to be hard to come by. So we'll need to ensure that capital and support dollars are available for the new groups of entrepreneurs. How that come later. Exactly what that looks like, you know, I have some details, but I actually think it would become much clearer as the crisis unfolds as to what types of strategies are really needed. So I would put this one, in my opinion, at the BFA, on the back burner compared to some of the other things we've heard about. So that is my testimony. The one piece I would add is amongst the requests we've received for loans, there's a significant amount in there from manufacturing companies who either already produce PPE or components that go into PPE or would start doing that in addition to what they do now. So there's, yes, a general, hey, let me need to support our economy message here, but there's actually a significant amount of public health supplies where this funding would help those supply chains.
Very good. Thank you, James. And I believe that Katie is on the line with us now. Are you there, Katie?
I am. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. The floor is yours.
Great. Thank you so much. This is Katie Easterly-Marte with the Community Development Finance Authority. I want to thank you for your support of our work and attention to this important task, especially on a late afternoon on a Friday. I'll just tell you a little bit about the Community Development Finance Authority, then speak for a few minutes about the needs as we're seeing them, and then some opportunities we see to make strategic investments going forward. The Community Development Finance Authority is a statewide community and economic development entity. We serve all in New Hampshire. We're a state-chartered, independent organization, and like other authorities like the BFA or New Hampshire Housing, our board is appointed by the governor and council. CDFA provides investments that help the people of New Hampshire. We deploy a well-tuned, effective investment system. We enable our partners to make transformative and substantial changes, and we take an innovative and collaborative approach to development finance. In order to do so, we provide a variety of financial resources. Those include the competitive deployment of grants, loans, and tax credit equity. In addition, our staff provide technical assistance to prospective applicants and ensure that the compliance requirements of all the funding that we administer are done so in a transparent and accountable way. Our impact is seen in revitalized downtowns, high-quality childcare facilities, renovated housing, clean energy projects, business expansions, and prior to the crisis, a very healthy and vibrant nonprofit sector. We see these areas as significant areas of need in our current situation. Our resources enable our partners to identify needs in communities. We provide data and information in order to better understand those needs and then ultimately provide solutions through the means that I expressed in terms of grants, tax credit equity, and loans so that we can support initiatives and projects at all stages. I want to provide just an example of the way that we've engaged in, with communities prior to the crisis, because I think it will provide some picture of how we could see things unfolding now that we're in the situation that we are. CDFA has been invested in the city of Franklin for over a decade. The first investment that we were able to facilitate about a decade ago was actually the renovation of a former school into a senior center, a child care center, which included both a Head Start and a private facility, and the city's rec department. Why that was so important is it allowed us to build a relationship with that municipality, businesses in the area, and the residents to really ensure that the long-term economic strategy for that community would be able to be supported. Since that time, about a decade ago, we've provided nearly six other awards into that community, and it's really started to change and grow the tax base in Franklin from one of the most challenged to something that really had, prior to this crisis, had a significant plan. We believe that that same philosophy, where you make targeted investments, as you've talked about as a committee, when you're really meeting the most urgent and current needs, and then looking to stabilize the most important institutions across our state, and then create an opportunity to reopen the economy, is really what makes the most sense in our current environment. I'll just speak a little bit about some of the current needs that we're seeing. I think you've heard from so many testimonials from various players, and I appreciate the time you've spent really listening to so many people. And so a lot of this might be duplicative of what you've heard. So I'll go through this quickly. We see some very significant needs from our nonprofit partners. As you know, they are the backbone of many social, educational, and other services across our state. We don't, like James, in terms of small businesses, assume that they will all survive this crisis, and it may not be appropriate for them to, but we do know that there are major institutions that need to have a presence both in this crisis and then through the crisis in order for our state to be able to continue to thrive. And it's our opinion that investments in those crucial institutions would be very timely and necessary. In addition, we've seen, obviously, the crisis, the housing crisis that we had prior to this, to the COVID pandemic, really exacerbate itself in communities. And we feel that there are ways that we can actually provide solutions that deal with the current health crisis and then are able to be solutions for the long term. We think that there's a significant need for investment into our main streets and the businesses in our communities. We feel that from all that we know and the information about New Hampshire's economy, that New Hampshire has an economy that's based on small businesses, that has strong relationships as suppliers to other businesses, and that it's about the places in New Hampshire, and that's what really attracts new residents, ensures people want to stay here, and has allowed our economy to grow. We feel like it's important to really understand the dynamics of the businesses in our community and ensure that there's resources that allow them to reopen in what we think will be a very new reality. We understand that all the needs of nonprofits, the housing needs, needs of childcare and educational facilities far outweigh the funds that are available for you to invest. And I just want to talk a little bit about what we're currently doing and then some ideas we have about ways that we've used data and other resources to prioritize the various investment opportunities. Our current response is really focused in three areas. The first was that we provided flexibility to our existing grantees and borrowers. We continue to invest the dollars that we administer on behalf of the state, particularly the housing and community development dollars. We made $3 million of recommendations last week for very important projects that range from food pantries, domestic violence shelters, housing solutions. And we have been able to work with those grantees to ensure that projects can go forward even in the current crisis and extend flexibility for the completion of those projects to longer, to allow them longer to be completed. In addition, providing just flexibility to our borrowers and grantees in the form of forbearance and other facilities that allow them to do important work in communities. And then shifting our existing resources to meet the current needs and creating the New Hampshire Nonprofit Response Fund to meet some of those immediate needs of New Hampshire's nonprofits. We knew that we needed to be flexible, nimble, and be able to respond quickly so that New Hampshire's nonprofits would have the capital that they need to meet immediate needs in their community. And we're seeing 6 times the number of requests for that New Hampshire Nonprofit Response Fund than we have funds available. But we're also seeing that nonprofits are really in part with businesses and others being very creative in the solutions that they're bringing forward in their communities, doing things like continuing to be able to provide dental services at an emergency for emergency procedures to keep people out of the hospital and ensure that those who can't go to private practice have a place to be able to be served, creating essential childcare facilities, meeting the various needs of residents in the care of nonprofit long-term facilities. As we look at the future and where resources could most create opportunity, we really look at the demographic, fiscal, and other data that can guide funding priorities. In 2019, CDFA embarked on an initiative to create data that was relevant, that is updated more at least on an annual basis, more readily, obviously, than the census data, which happens on every 10 years and then has a lag as it becomes estimates later into that process. And so we really want to ensure that investments that we create are having a measurable impact in communities and related to that data. And we've seen that when we're able to make those investments that really connect various aspects of a community, that we can ensure that the institutions that our residents most rely on are available. I think of an investment we made in Cottage Hospital in Woodsville, and they were looking at a public investment of funds to support some very significant private investments to create a practice in which they would be able to provide OT and regular primary care. And what that allowed them to do was actually to continue to have a full-time social worker on staff who was able to liaison with the school district and ensure that those services were provided. And it allowed them to stabilize their institution financially over the long run and ensure that they could continue to have an ER open in that area of the state, even though it needed to be balanced with other revenue. And so we're really looking at, when we make investments at CDFA, looking at data about where those investments will make the most impact, and then ensuring that we're looking at the whole picture of that community for long-term financial sustainability. And I guess as we've been thinking about how to prioritize our investments in this current crisis, both in the short run and the midterm, that's really what we're thinking about, is how to take the best advantage of the opportunities that the state has. We have significant amounts of open space, which allow people to do the things that they're doing now in social distancing, but as we slowly reopen, maybe to do that in a way that just slowly rebuilds our economy. We think investments in those types of sectors makes a lot of sense. Also, as I said, ensuring that the cores of our community, those town centers and main streets, are able to be flexible and adapt to this new economy we imagine is gonna slowly reopen, ensuring that they have the resources to be able to rethink how they serve customers and ensure that they can be part of the long-term solution. So I'm happy to answer any questions. I have a lot of information about investments we've been able to make in communities and also the way that we could scale our administrative capacities to
if it's appropriate, help ensure that funds are able to be received by communities and nonprofits and small businesses to help in the immediate crisis and the rebuilding. I'll stop there because I know our time's limited and I want to be sure to be able to answer any questions that there are.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Katie. And just a heads up to our next presenters, Chris McCracken and Christine Stoddard. We're going to get to you in just a moment. I hope you're still with us and stand by. We do have a request for a question or comment from Senator Susie.
Thank you, Commissioner Little. Thank you to both the presenters. Really, really fantastic testimony and very helpful and a lot to think about. My question is actually for James, if I may, and that is regarding the programs that you suggested and or recommended. First off, BFA is an extraordinary resource to businesses throughout the state and has a fabulous record and extraordinary processes. I'm wondering if taking on added responsibility, such as you outlined, would require additional staffing.
Thank you, Senator. I think the answer is it depends. I had broken the framework into different components. I think that under component one, which is a broadly available $75 million support package, if that were made available in full, I think the answer is yes, we would have to add one additional staff member. They have been identified on a contingency basis, just in case it's needed. That staff member would primarily be responsible for ensuring that all new applicants are responded to quickly and get through the queue. If component two, which is a much larger industry-specific relief program, were to be put into place, the amount of funding made available would drive the amount of loans and grants, forgivable loans, we would process. So we may have to add anywhere between one and three additional staff members, depending on the amount of funding that was made available, which is within our capacity to do.
Excellent. Thank you again. Very helpful information. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank
further
you.
Further questions for either the Business Finance Authority or the Community Development Finance Authority? Just going to give it a minute. If anybody wants to five-star to let us know they have a question. I don't believe so. So, James and Katie, thank you both very much. Excellent presentations, great information.
Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, everybody. Stay safe.
Thank you. And our final plan presentation for this afternoon is one that I believe, I think it was Senator Susie requested that we speak with Manchester Mental Health, Chris McCracken, and Chris reached out and asked Christine Stoddard to join her as well. And ladies, the floor is yours. Chris McCracken, are you with us?
I am, and thank you. I'm just going to make one slight adjustment to your introduction. I'm actually with Amiskeag Health. We do work closely with our local mental health center, but we're the federally qualified health center. And Christine Stoddard is going to start our shared presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Christine. Can you hear me okay?
We hear you very well. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Christine Stoddard, and I am at my home office alone. My kids are somewhere in the house with my husband. I am the Director of Public Policy for Bi-State Primary Care Association, and Bi-State is a nonprofit organization that works to expand access to primary and preventive care for all New Hampshire residents. We also have memberships, and they include New Hampshire's 14 community health centers, including the federally qualified health centers like CHRIS, family planning providers, and rural health clinics. We also have a healthcare consortium and an a community health access network in our membership. But today I'm going to focus on the community health centers. All of New Hampshire's community health centers are small nonprofit organizations that are located in medically underserved areas. They provide integrated primary care, oral health, substance use disorder treatment, and behavioral health services to nearly 122,000 patients at 56 locations. The majority of their patients live at or below 200% of the federal poverty level, which is about $25,000 for a single person. Community health centers are required to serve all patients, regardless of their ability to pay or insurance status, and they offer what is known as a sliding fee discount to their patients based on income for those patients that are uninsured and underinsured. Each health center offers a different array of services designed to meet the needs of their communities, and their patient and payer mixes are very different. But each health center accepts Medicare, Medicaid, commercial insurance, and obviously also treats uninsured patients. So since the governor's declaration of emergency on March 13th, the health centers have established telehealth services in a matter of days. They've reconfigured their billing systems to reflect the point of service changes, allowing practitioners to practice from their homes and patients to access services from their homes. They've also consolidated practices to accommodate for COVID testing and patients who test positive while maintaining safe spaces for regular visits that cannot be done via telehealth, such as well-child visits that require immunizations and prenatal visits. We also have a number of health centers that have dental practices, and those practices remain open for emergencies, and they have been seeing a number of patients there. And like healthcare organizations across New Hampshire and across the country, our health centers have struggled to obtain PPE, including gowns and surgical masks, and COVID testing supplies. All of our health centers are mission-driven, just like Bi-State, and they are required to see all patients. And the financial ramifications and access from what's going on in our healthcare system right now has limited their ability to do so. So I wanted to give you a little bit of background about what's been happening at the health centers. So the federally qualified health centers are a subset of the health centers in New Hampshire. They're regulated by the federal government by an agency called Health Resources and Services Administration. And HRSA, as it's known, conducts a biweekly survey of the FQHCs to find out what's going on the ground so that they can get a better idea of how they need to adjust their policies and possibly funding. And so as of April 10th, those FQHCs have seen nearly a 50% drop in patient visits compared to the pre-COVID-19 days. Those FQHCs have temporarily closed 7 sites due to site consolidation and safety issues. We have 3 homeless FQHCs in the state of New Hampshire, and so those are designed to treat homeless patients. And they also operate within homeless shelters. And as Martha indicated earlier, it's not safe, and you can't follow the CDC recommendations inside a homeless shelter with the beds that are so close. And so those sites have shut down. Approximately 55% of those FQHCs have COVID-19 testing capacity. So that's 5 health centers. We also have 44% of the health centers that have drive-up or walk-up testing capacity. A number of our health centers have set up tents outside of their brick-and-mortar office building to accommodate for drive-up testing. And this is a great example of their ability to adapt and innovate and serve their communities. We know that 80% of the health center visits are now being conducted virtually, which is terrific. However, this week, the top issues facing the health centers are still the decline in patient visits, which leads to issues with reimbursement and financial stability. They've also seen an increase in reimbursement issues for telehealth and from Medicare specifically. And the last issue that they've identified is meeting the needs of their special populations, like the homeless populations that they serve, and also people that experience substance use disorder treatment or needs, and also those with behavioral health needs. So the effects of the nearly 50% reduction in patient visits isn't just solely a workforce or workflow issue. It also severely impacts the financial health of the health centers. There was an analysis done by a company called CAPINC recently of those 10 FQHCs again that found that 43% of those FQHCs will exhaust all of their operating reserves, and 43 health centers have less than 30 days cash on hand. That same study also calculated that our health centers have furloughed over 300 staff, which is a significant amount of their staff. And the health centers with large dental practices like Greater Seacoast Community Health, Amanoosic Community Health Services, and also Mid-State, which is in the Bristol-Plymouth region, have seen larger decreases in their revenue because of their dental practices being limited to serve emergencies only. Our CEOs have estimated that even if they could serve 90% of their former patient volume via telehealth, it would equate to about 60% of their in-person revenue. And that's just due to the reimbursement changes that have been happening. This has also exacerbated a longstanding pre-existing issue pre-COVID-19 with our Medicaid managed care program and the health center's reimbursement challenges there. And as I've mentioned, it also brought front a issue with Medicare. And as you can guess, a large percentage of the FQHCs and the other health centers in New Hampshire serve a good chunk of our Medicare population. It's about, I think they're patient demographics, 22% of the patients of community health centers are on Medicare. So telehealth has been a godsend for the community health centers. They continue to report that the transition has gone very well. And I think this is due in large part to the hard work of the Department of Health and Human Services and the governor's office. Every health center has expressed hope that the telehealth capabilities continue after the COVID-19 pandemic have ended because it increases access to care, which is what they are there for. For example, one of our chief medical officers at our Seacoast Health Center reported that they've actually seen an increase in behavioral health services as a result of telehealth because patients who were previously hesitant to engage in behavioral health services we're more willing to do that now because they're in the comfort of their own home. Like I've said, though, there are some challenges with telehealth, and that is largely Medicare. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services made a number of changes to the Medicare program and the provision of services via telehealth. However, most of them were not applicable to the federally qualified health centers and the rural health clinics. And those clinics are designed to serve low-income people in rural areas, and they cannot get the same reimbursement that they would be getting if the person would come into the office, which is really unfortunate because that's the exact population that you don't want coming into the office if they don't have to. And so this is worsened by the fact that a number of our residents in New Hampshire don't have access to broadband, Wi-Fi, the internet at all, and a large number of them also only have telephones, and so they don't have smartphones that have audio-visual capabilities, and so that reduces the reimbursement rate that the FQHCs and the RHCs can get from Medicare, and it also introduces a cost-sharing component for the Medicare beneficiaries. And so until, I guess, Monday, actually, if the health center billed Medicare for any services provided to a Medicare beneficiary, what would have happened at the patient's end of the transaction was they would have received an explanation of benefits saying that there was cost-sharing that they were responsible for paying. And we are working as hard as we can to resolve this, but it still remains a huge barrier for the health centers and also Medicare beneficiaries. So the third thing that our health centers report as an outstanding issue this week is, as I mentioned, caring for those special populations. And just to be clear, primary care needs, behavioral health needs, oral health needs, substance use disorder treatment needs are not going away because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And we and our members encourage all of us to tell our loved ones that if you need to access care, if you are in need of care, please call your primary care providers, call a community health center. Don't delay accessing care because of the pandemic. I'm sure that you've all seen reports in the news of this happening and unfortunate results because of it. And we want everyone to know that the health centers are open. It's just you might access care in a different way. Our health centers have actually reported an increased demand for substance use disorder treatment and behavioral health services because of the stress of the COVID-19 situation. They know that their patients have lost their jobs, that there's a lack of space for housing, as Martha indicated, and that there has been an impact on the homeless shelters in New Hampshire and across the state. And this has all resulted in people delaying or foregoing necessary care. The health centers have tried and will continue to try to respond with innovative solutions. For example, the Greater Seacoast Community Health Center launched a pilot program that is medication-assisted recovery services in a minivan. And so they will meet patients where they are in the Seacoast region to make sure that people are getting their MAR services. And as I mentioned, we also have three health centers that are designed to treat people experiencing homelessness, one in Manchester, one in Nashua, and one in Portsmouth. And so they're working with the shelters in their areas and congregate housing and also the hotels that Martha mentioned to make sure that people are living in safe conditions and that they, too, are accessing care appropriately. Unfortunately, our health centers also serve a disproportionate number of patients living with chronic conditions like diabetes. And so they are working with those patients to make sure that they have the care that they need, and if they need to come into the office, that they can, and they can do that in a safe manner. We just want to make sure, again, that people aren't delaying care. And fortunately, a number of our health centers have been able to access federal support through the CARES Act and other provisions, and those are the federally qualified health centers, which, like I said, are a set of the community health centers. Those CHCs have received $1 million now in federal support. Excuse me. And that funding was limited to the COVID-19 response. It provides one-time support to the health centers for the detection of the virus, the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of COVID-19. It's not a slush fund by any means. Excuse me, I have a tickle in my throat. And so they are using that money to maintain health center capacity and staffing during the virus. Bi-State and our members are very grateful for that federal support, but it will not make up for the loss in patient revenues. And just to give you an idea of what that compares to their operating costs, it will not cover a month's worth of payroll for the health centers. And also in terms of good news, three of our health centers, Amiskig Health, Charlestown Health Center, and Weeks Medical Center, their rural health clinic, have received funding from the state's emergency health care system. But there are two of our members that have not received any federal support or any state support. And those are the two that we're worried about most. Those are Planned Parenthood of Northern New England and White Mountain Community Health Center. White Mountain is what's called an FQHC lookalike. It has the same restrictions as an FQHC, meaning it's required to have a patient majority board. It's required to treat everyone without regard to ability to pay. But it does not benefit financially from any of the federal FQHC funding. So moving forward, we know that there is a large amount of uncertainty about how to keep healthcare providers' doors open, especially when we're living in a time of significant drop in revenue. But we know also that from a public health perspective, it's important to have primary care available to treat patients so that their symptoms don't become worse and they don't end up in the emergency room, because we know that we need hospitals open and able to treat people if there is a surge in the near future. And so we want to make sure that people can access primary care, preventive care, substance use disorder treatment, oral health services, and behavioral health moving forward. Our health centers, as I mentioned, are all open. Their model might look different, but they are seeing patients, and they're doing the best that they can in a difficult situation. So I'd like to now hand it over to Chris to talk to you, and then feel free to ask me any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Christine. Good afternoon, Commissioner Little and distinguished members of the Bipartisan Gopher Legislative Advisory Board. My name is Chris McCracken, and I serve as the President and CEO of Amiskake Health, one of the federally qualified health centers in Manchester. Thank you for allowing me a few minutes to illustrate the impact of the COVID epidemic on our health center as an example of the impact just described to you by Christine Stoddard about health centers across the state. I listened to the earlier testimony from Kathleen Reardon and Dick Ober, and I believe you see alignment between these testimonies. To provide some context, we have been providing healthcare services in Manchester for 27 years to the highest risk and neediest individuals in our community. We have about 5 locations of care, one on each of the 2 hospital campuses and one in the local mental health center, and 2 sites in our downtown area, one of them being a pediatric site. We served over 14,000 patients last year with approximately 203 FTEs, equivocally about 237 staff, I think, in our budget. Approximately 5,500 of our patients are children. Over 80% of them live at or below poverty, and over 44% of our 67,000 visits last year were provided through an interpreter in one of the 62 languages spoken in our community. We have 12 interpreters on staff to manage the language diversity in our region. Approximately 45% of our patients are on Medicaid, about 7% on Medicare, 23% have private insurance, and about 25% of our patients are uninsured. We provide not only primary and prenatal care, but also behavioral health, substance use disorder, and MAT treatment, case management, nutrition, diabetic education, lactation services, podiatry, optometry, school-based behavioral health and community health workers. And we also have a special grant to coordinate the provision of special medical services to high-risk children statewide. Beginning with the declaration of an emergency by the president, our health center, like so many other organizations, had to quickly plan a method to manage the care in the confines of CDC's guidelines. That meant a complex process to stand up a mechanism to move as many of our staff to working remotely as possible, folding 5 clinics down to 2 clinics, and taking, literally thousands of appointments and stratifying them into those that must be seen in person, those that can be delayed, and those that could be managed via telehealth. We had to quickly purchase software tools and laptops to allow us to move to work, to have staff working remotely, and stand up telehealth software. My apologies. We implemented an active screening system with 2 screeners in the front of both facilities to take the temperature of all patients and staff and to screen them for COVID-like symptoms. We implemented that response team 6 weeks ago. We meet daily, and I've shared a copy with you of the daily newsletter we are producing because the landscape we are working is changing so rapidly, and we're trying to communicate with staff operating from multiple sites and from their homes. We implemented an active, We have 23 positions that we have frozen that were naturally occurring vacancies, and we have 3 staff that we've furloughed. We normally see around 260 visits a day, but we're currently seeing about 50% of that volume, and we continue to move additional services to virtual care when possible or practical. Our anticipated loss through June is at about an estimate of $1.5 million on our $19 million budget. Our margin on that budget would have been around $140,000 had there been no interruption to services, meaning there's really not sufficient margin there to support the losses being incurred. We lost around $500,000 of revenue in 6 weeks, and I've provided you a copy of that information with our visit volume, and we're projecting a loss of about an additional $1 million in the next 8 weeks. In addition, we've needed to cancel our largest annual fundraiser, Morning Matters,
due to the need to follow the guidelines around large gatherings, which is in about a $60,000 to $70,000 profit for our organization. For our health center, one payroll is around $550,000. Although we've had the benefit of the HRSA grant through the CARES Act, that grant is sufficient to cover about 3 weeks of our payroll. We are also about 50% grant funded, and we're deeply concerned about the cuts we anticipate in the next few months as our normal foundations realize the endowments they oversee have been severely impacted by the losses in the market and by the potential future cuts to general funds for any one of our 13 state contracts because the state is going to need to recover financially as well. Before the pandemic, we had about 230 staff sharing a mix of 130 desktops and 100 laptops. We've had to rapidly get access to almost 100 individuals for laptops and about 150 to have phone coverage through special licenses so that they can call patients from home without giving out their personal home phone numbers or cell phone numbers. We've had to move several thousand appointments and contact each one to see if they needed to be seen in person, could be seen via telehealth, and then train them and get them set up through multiple languages. We've implemented Zoom, Microsoft Teams, DoxyMe, and several specialized licenses to allow remote access into work. We've invested over $60,000 in technology alone over a period of 30 days. We've also had to quickly move to translate materials into multiple other languages to make them available to our patients with limited English proficiency so that they could learn about COVID-19, social isolation, hand washing, and other topics. A great deal of difficulty and expense has been around the procurement of PPE. For example, a face mask used to cost 10 cents 3 months ago. Now it costs over 80 cents. We've had anywhere from 40 to 60 staff out sick in a week, self-quarantining or managing children or sick loved ones on a daily basis. So we're stretching staff to cover multiple roles. Originally, up until 2 weeks ago, all local COVID testing was being coordinated through the Armory site, but we have since then set up our own site testing at our acute clinic location. We've managed to work the test result turnaround time to around 48 hours. Although this is an improvement, the volume of testing needed is still woefully insufficient, and the need for antibody testing is urgent so that we can begin to identify individuals that have safely made it through an infection and now might be available to care for those at high risk. For 2 weeks, we operated an emergency on-site childcare so we could help our staff get set up and working remotely and to give them time to make plans for their children that had to stay home. We have stocked our food pantries at both locations, and on a weekly basis, our case managers and community health workers are now handing out food boxes to our patients. Each Wednesday, they are referring families identified in need that week through a drive-through pickup service of a week's worth of food. This week, 8 staff members and 2 volunteers worked for several hours to pick up, sort, and bag all of the supplies, and they served over 120 families representing 578 individuals, over 5,000 pounds of food purchased from New Hampshire Food Bank. We've already spent over $10,000 in just 4 weeks to support our patients' food needs. The need for remote support for our case managers in the middle of this crisis has been significant. Patients that have never needed help from our case managers or community health workers are newly accessing services in response to their own urgent situation with a loss of income and jobs, insurance coverage, and an inability to access food, lack of internet access for their children to participate in school, and other needs. Because of our role in the city, we've been asked, along with another agency, by our local United Way to create a case management system to support all community residents, whether or not they are patients, and assist them with navigating these kinds of services and getting them funds for barrier reductions. We managed to stand that system up in a matter of 2 weeks with their help. These are just a few practical examples of the way that the crisis has impacted one health center. We know that the impact is similar in other health centers and the family planning clinics. We recognize you are charged with an impossible task, dividing these resources across so many sectors. We hope that some of these resources will be set aside to support the nonprofit healthcare infrastructure in this state, who will continue to need the support to provide that ongoing primary care, behavioral health, and substance use disorder services to those most at risk in our state. I realize it's a huge demand on your time and a difficult burden to balance. We thank you for your time, your consideration, and your commitment to this process, and we're happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Chris. Are there any questions for either Chris McCracken or Christine Stoddard? We'll give you a moment to hit 5-star. Well, seeing none, thank you very much, Chris and Christine. Thank you for those presentations.
We're
at the end of today's agenda. I'll just do a quick wrap-up, and certainly if any of the members of the committee have any further questions they would like to make about anything they've heard today or anything in general, just hit 5-star, and we'll come right to you. I just want to circle back and read off the list of requests that I've heard so far this afternoon. From Representative Wallner, you've requested an accounting of what state agencies have spent to date that is COVID-19 specific. You would like an accounting of how much the state of New Hampshire has spent on paid family leave for state employees. You would like to have an update of Governor Sununu's chart on approved COVID-19 expenses. And you're also wondering how much did the 12 surge sites cost to set up and who paid for them. And again, I apologize, you had asked for that earlier, and I let that slip. I'm sorry. From Senator Morse, you requested presentations from healthcare emergency responders and agriculture. And Senator Morse will let you know that we've already arranged or we're setting up presentations from the state fire marshal and American Medical Response for Wednesday next week. We will work on the agriculture piece of that. Senator Reagan would like to hear from the insurance department or the insurance industry on business interruption insurance. Are they paying any out? If not, why? And from Senator D'Alessandro, what is Harry Plummer at the Homeland Security Office hearing regarding the likelihood that FEMA will cover 100% of disaster-related costs? Is there anything else that I've missed that you have asked for already today? Or anything you'd like to add? And don't forget 5-star, if you'd like to speak, we can open your mic. Do you have any further questions? Representative Wallner.
Thank you, Mr. Little. I was, from today's presentation, I heard a lot of references to child care, and I wondered if we could have a presentation from the child care community about how this is. I don't think a lot of places will open up until children are able to be cared for by their child care providers, so I think it's an important piece of this whole issue. And the other piece that I was wondering about is whether or not we're going to be able to get the area agencies in to talk about the disabilities community.
The answer to all of those, both of those questions is yes. I was contacted earlier this morning by Scott Spradling, who represents Early Learning New Hampshire, and we're working with them. It looks like we're probably going to be talking with them Friday next week, as our Monday and Wednesday agendas are already filled out. And we also have presentations coming up next week from the DD and other agencies. I'm trying to pull up my agenda for... I guess it's on Monday, so let me just tell you what this is posted on the governor's website under the tab for the Gopher office. Your Monday agenda is Jay Kucher, Executive Director, Seacoast Mental Health Centers and President of Community Behavioral Health Association, represented by Richard Lammy. Then Granite State Independent Living Foundation. Presenter will be Deborah Ritchie. Following that, we'll hear from Home Care, Hospice, and Palliative Care Alliance of New Hampshire from Gina Balkis. And after that, Harbor House, New Hampshire Homeless Veterans, and they have four speakers for us. And then finally on Monday, we have added federal guidance analysis by Gopher General Counsel Nancy Smith. And as I mentioned earlier, we have other folks coming in, safety-related people, the fire marshal, AMR, ambulance rescue, and some others, a full agenda on Wednesday as well, and and the child care folks kicking the day off on Friday. Oh, I know, on Wednesday we've got the pharmacy folks coming in, both the independents and the chains, and a number of other healthcare-related. I know we had asked for dental and doctors and optometrists, so that's your Wednesday agenda. I just don't have the names in front of me right now.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Anything else for the good of the order from anyone, or anybody just have a statement they would like to make? If so, hit 5-star. And if not, thank you all very much for all you're doing. Really appreciate it. Sometime next week, I hope to have the conversation. Obviously, we're building out the agendas for Monday, Wednesday, and we're into Friday at this point in time. But please spend some thought about the pivot from these public sessions where we're accepting more testimony to conversations identifying 8 or 10 major segments of the economy that we want to begin discussing, what sort of assistance should we be giving from the CARES Act funds, and what sort of weight and priority. What we have heard constantly over the past 2 weeks is that this is a dire and unfortunate situation, and while the $1.24 billion sounds like an awful lot, it won't be enough, and we're going to need to triage, and that is never a fun exercise to go through. So thank you for your contribution and for your commitment, all of you, and I hope you have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you, Jerry.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Thanks, Jerry.